It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Department of Natural Resources says Wisconsin may be experiencing one of the worst spongy moth caterpillar outbreaks in more than a decade. We learn how these invasive insects affect our forested areas, and you can join the conversation by calling with your question or comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Patrick Engelken, who is an entomologist in forest health protection at the U.S. Department of Agriculture Forest Service. Patrick, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Happy to be here.
Good morning. So 10 counties within the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest are in active quarantine due to the spongy moth. When does a quarantine become necessary to protect, you know, to protect the trees from the spongy moth?
So when you have a population within a county that is no longer considered to be able to be eradicated from within the county, it means that there's going to be continual growth and persistence of the spongy moth within the boundary. And at that point, it's really important to get the quarantine enacted to prevent movement from that county into other uninfested areas.
And so in this case, this quarantine means that, you know, you can't move like wood products or, you know, some other outdoor household things. They have to be inspected before moving them to and from a quarantined area from a non-quarantined area. How well do quarantines work to contain an outbreak?
Quarantines work really well when they're abided by. Yeah, like you mentioned, if you're in a quarantined area and you're moving wood products, especially sawwood, pulpwood, logs, things like that, they need to be inspected. There's a lot of documentation that goes into it. Oftentimes, they need to be treated with something like a heat treatment or something before they're moved out of the county. Also, when you're moving things like outdoor equipment, RVs, and things from around your house, you should really inspect those thoroughly. And when it's done well and people are vigilant and look for the life stages of spongy moth, they work really well. Spongy moth, unfortunately, it's not going anywhere and it's going to likely move eventually. But the longer we can keep the line, the better off we're going to be.
So basically, the spongy moth caterpillars can hitch a ride on anything.
Yeah, so the spongy moth that we have here in Wisconsin, comes largely from Europe, and the females of this species, they don't fly. They have fully intact wings, but they don't use them. They can't use them. So they're not particularly picky where they lay their egg masses. If they get knocked off on your camper, on your lawn chairs, if they are on a log, that's where they're going to lay their egg masses. And what they like to do is they like to kind of tuck themselves into a tight, hard to reach area where they lay their egg masses to kind of protect themselves from predators and from the weather and things and the winter weather. And also early instar small larvae, when they're coming out of their egg masses, they're really small and they're hard to see. And they do this thing called ballooning where they'll kind of spin a little silk thread and they'll kind of drop out of the canopy and they could blow into your truck bed. They could blow onto your RV or onto your other equipment there, and they're really good at hitchhiking, and they really are hard to detect if you're not looking for them.
What can they do to a forest?
Well, in high populations, when you have really high outbreak populations of spongy moth, they can completely defoliate every host tree in an entire stand. I've seen it in Michigan and also in some places in Wisconsin where all of the highly preferred trees, all of the oaks, all of the aspens, all the poplars, they just eat every leaf off of every tree. And it's really stressful for those trees. Spongy moth's an early season defoliator, which means that the leaves that it's eating are leaves that are being pushed out in early spring that are largely produced from stored root reserves from the fall, the previous year. So when they're eating all of those leaves, the trees, they have to reflush. They have to put out new leaves, which means they're tapping further into the reserves they have. So It's really stressful to those trees. When you see repeated high defoliation events, you can start to see some mortality occur or some decline start to occur in those trees in the forest as well.
Patrick Engelken is a USDA entomologist. As we talk about the life cycle of the spongy moth caterpillar, the outbreak in Wisconsin, you can join in the conversation, your questions, and what you see out there. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Patrick, in May, the insect diagnostic lab manager at UW-Madison, PJ Leash, was sharing predictions about the spongy moth on the Larry Mueller show.
If we have rainy conditions for this spring going forward, that could really help us out and turn the tide. But if things turn drier again, then those caterpillars are probably going to have a really good year and could cause an awful lot of defoliation in the state.
Okay, so that was back in May, and we are dry. Wisconsin has experienced drought conditions this summer. To what degree are drought conditions here affecting the spongy moth population?
So I guess it's kind of twofold. The first thing is when you have a really dry conditions, your trees are going to be more stressed. They're going to put less defenses into their tree, into their leaves. They're going to be more palatable, more easily digestible. Caterpillars are going to be able to develop better on them. You're going to see more robust females. They're going to be able to lay larger egg masses. So you're going to have higher populations of next year. The other probably more obvious thing is that the population dynamics of spongy moth are largely controlled by two diseases that are largely endemic within populations of spongy moth, but really build up to high volumes in populations when you have wet weather. There's a fungal pathogen that's Entomophaga mimega that really does well in wet conditions. It sporulates really effectively and can really spread between caterpillars in wet conditions. And there's a virus as well, NPV, nucleopolyhydrosis virus, that's not really... The wet springs don't really impact it nearly as much, but wetter weather certainly doesn't hurt it either. So when you have really wet weather, the trees are going to be more vigorous, be able to put more defenses in their leaves, be less digestible, and you're going to have a much more beneficial environment for that fungus that's going to be really important in kind of limiting the expansion, explosion of populations of spongy moth and kind of triggering a collapse in an outbreak, which is usually what happens once you reach really high populations of spongy moth.
Without the fungal pathogen, would there be animals or other insects that would eat spongy moths?
Yeah, birds will eat them. Other things will eat them. You have early instar larvae, you'll have insects that'll feed on them. Things like ladybugs, they'll feed on them as well when they're small. But they don't really feed on them in high enough numbers to cause collapses in outbreak populations.
I think that they're behind on their work. It's not making an impact.
they got their work cut out for them for sure. Yeah, they're not going to be nearly as effective. They'll surely be well fed, but they're not going to be able to stop an outbreak or trigger a collapse in an outbreak and get it back to more manageable populations that we're looking for.
We have USDA Forest Service entomologist Patrick Engelken helping us understand the spongy moth outbreak in Wisconsin. Call in with your questions or share a comment, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Spongy moth caterpillars feed on hundreds of species of trees and shrubs. The State Department of Natural Resources says it could be one of the worst outbreaks in years. We examine defoliation in forested areas and efforts underway to contain the invasive insects. Call in with your question or concern at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Patrick Engelken is a USDA Forest Service entomologist. Patrick, with the defoliation, we talked about quarantine. When would we know if a quarantine is preventing or stopping the defoliation? And then what would be the next steps?
So it's really hard to tell if the quarantine is working in that extent. What you really need, what we really do is we trap for spongy moth. And we track the movement and the spread of it. Spongy moth, the populations are always expanding. The front is always moving. We're looking to slow the spread of it, slow the movement of it into unquarantined counties. So every year that we don't have populations pop up in an uninfested county is a success for that quarantine. They're likely going to have spongy moth populations eventually, whether through natural spread or through movement of materials. But the goal is annual prevention of spread into unquarantined counties.
And so when we track it, would that be like counting the number of trees that are defoliated in an area? How do you track it?
So spongy moth, like I mentioned earlier, the females of the variant that we have in Wisconsin don't fly. So the males are really effective at finding females. So we have a really effective pheromone lure that we're able to put in traps, sticky delta traps that we can hang in a grid across the state, and we can see where the populations are based on where we're catching male moths. So if you're driving around in Wisconsin, you might see these traps. They're hung. We have thousands of them throughout the state. And every year, the state will bring them in. They'll look at them. They'll see what the numbers are, and we'll kind of get a map of where spongy moth is in the state of this year, and we can compare that to what previous years look like.
Speaking of traps, my neighbors and I, we've been talking about these burlap wrap traps kind of around the tree. Can you describe that tactic?
Yeah, so burlap bags, that's an old school tactic. People have been doing that for a long time. So,
we're new to it.
Yeah, and I understand. The caterpillars, they will crawl up and down the tree. And when you tie a burlap sack around the tree, they'll kind of get bound up in that, and they won't be able to move up and down. You'll capture a lot of caterpillars that way. Sometimes they'll do it with burlap. Sometimes you'll wrap the tree and you'll put some something sticky on it, like pest stick, and that'll capture them as well.
And then each day you kind of remove them from underneath the burlap. Is that the goal?
Yeah, you can remove them. And then once they hatch out, they'll go up and down the tree and they'll get stuck in it. Yeah, you can remove them. That'll effectively take as many caterpillars as you can off your tree.
All right. What about insecticides? What can you tell us about that path?
So probably the most common insecticide that's used to control spongy moth, it's BTK. It's a non-contact insecticide that is applied to early instar caterpillars, usually through aerial application. It's toxic to them when they eat the leaf material that has that BT sprayed on it. It's toxic to those early instar caterpillars. It has its drawbacks in that it's not species specific to spongy moth. So it requires some really effective application timing to really hit when the spongy moth are out there, but your other Lepidopteras that you're concerned about are not also out there. The good thing about it is it doesn't really persist on the landscape that long. Once it's out there, it degrades really quickly. So if you can hit them when they're early, you can really hammer them. And we usually do two applications in the spring of that, so we can kind of hit that entire window of the spongy moth hatch, so we can get the caterpillars when they're all coming out. There's another product that's really effective. It's based off of the virus that I mentioned earlier. It's called GypCheck. It's made out of, you rear caterpillars, and when you'll infect them with the virus, and you'll make a product out of that, and they apply that as well. That's not being made in the United States anymore. The contract ran out and it wasn't renewed, so there's limited supply of that. But in areas where we have high concerns of other lepidopterans in the area, if we have something like Karner blue butterfly or other endangered leps, it's a product that we'll often use to spray. And again, aerially in those forests, it essentially really heightens the viral load in the forest to cause high levels of mortality of caterpillars. Those are really the two biggest that we use for suppression. Mimic, which is an insect growth regulator, is used in other parts of the country as well. It's not really specific in its reach. It's essentially it. It's an insect growth regulator, so it makes it so that insects can't molt, larvae can't molt, so they'll die. But it's not limited to Lepidoptera at all. It can get any insects that molt. So it's there's a lot of concerns with Mimic as well. But in Wisconsin, as I mentioned, the two that we're going to be using for suppression are going to be BTK and GipCheck when applicable. Again, as I mentioned, the pheromones really effective at attracting males. So there's another pheromone product that we use that's we use mating disruption product where we'll go along the leading edge of the invasion. And there's a national project called the Spongy Moth Slow the Spread Project, where we'll go along the leading edge of the spongy moth invasion. We'll use again aerial application of this pheromone product to target low-level populations that kind of limits their ability to reproduce and spread again. So we'll again we use the trap data to highlight
Okay.
where the moth is
Yeah.
moving, and we use that pheromone product to spray along the leading edge in areas where it looks like populations are building. So
Oh.
that really works well at low densities. It doesn't work well at high densities. You need forests with low populations where the males are really going to have to look to find the females. So when you kind of inundate the forest with pheromone, they really can't effectively do that.
Patrick Engelken, USDA entomologist, as we talk about the spongy moth outbreak in Wisconsin, 800-642-1234 to join in. Going all the way back to BT, the Bacillus thuringiensis, is that harmful to people or pets? How does it break down in the environment?
It's not harmful to humans. No, there have been a lot of tests on BT. It's used across all sorts of different industries, whether agricultural or forestry related. It targets Lepidoptera, and it's not contact. If it sprays on you, there's a number of innates in it as well that they're not going to be toxic to mammals or invertebrates really. It decays really rapidly in sunlight. So when the sun gets on it, the chemical compound that makes it up, it degrades. And
Do you know the suppression or the spraying that is going on in Wisconsin or what to expect?
like where it is or what we're doing, or what are you
Yeah,
trying to ask me?
like when it happens and where it's happening. I mean, you said about along the leading edge. Are there areas of Wisconsin that are being sprayed specifically?
So the leading edge, that's that mating disruption for the Slow the Spread project. For that, we spray kind of, if you look at the quarantine map or at the of spongy moth, we really spray along ahead of that wave. So a lot
Okay.
of we spray a lot around Eau Claire. We were up in the Superior area earlier this year, down near Platteville. We spray a lot of acres for that. For BT, for the again, there's the state can have some suppression dollars where they'll go in and they'll target areas that have really high populations to cause them to collapse. Those are likely. I'm not aware of where they sprayed this year. I know they had some areas they sprayed, I think, maybe over around Madison or the Green Bay area.
Can you leave us with one tip that people can do to see if they see egg masses or spongy moth caterpillars in their own backyard or neighborhood, what they can do?
Sure. Yeah. So if you're in an area that is not quarantined and you see spongy moth egg masses on your tree, reach out to your local state or your USDA branch and definitely let them know that you found it. They'll be very interested to know it's there. If you have it on your tree in your yard and you're in a quarantined area and you don't want to see those caterpillars on your tree, you can do one of two things. You could scrape it off and put it in like a solution of soapy water, or you can spray it with something like a horticultural oil that will kill it as well. Each egg mass will have anywhere from a couple hundred up to 1,000 eggs in it. So every egg mass you take out, that's up to 1,000 caterpillars you won't see on your tree later that spring.
Wow, that can be quite an impact then.
Yeah, it definitely will have an impact on your tree. If you see a couple egg masses on your tree and you scrape them off or you take them out, that'll definitely lighten the load on your tree. It won't really make an impact landscape wide, just with how many moths and caterpillars are out there, but on an individual tree or a yard basis, yeah, it can really make a noticeable impact.
Patrick, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. Happy to be on.
Patrick Engelken is an entomologist in forest health protection at the U.S. Department of Agriculture Forest Service. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a nonprofit helping families in the Madison area.
For many survivors of domestic abuse, finding affordable housing can be a challenge. And then finding furniture to fill that new space, that can be less of a priority. But as WPR's Gabby Vinnick reports, one nonprofit is providing families in Dane County with sofas, beds, and decor to turn their apartments into homes.
Jaisha?
Yeah.
Okay, she likes blue.
How about these?
Oh, give them those. Okay.
All right.
Oh, what about those pink light lamps?
Yeah.
It's a Saturday morning, and Felicia Denny is on a mission. She needs to find furniture for a family of two sisters. They need items like a couch, a bookshelf, and an end table. We're on the second floor of Denny's house. She and her mom are choosing furniture for a family she's never met. Their work is part of an organization she founded during the pandemic called Felicia's Donation Closet.
What we do is we fully furnish abused women and children's apartments when they move out of homelessness.
Denny and her crew of volunteers help make a family or individual's house or apartment feel like home. To date, they've furnished more than 50 apartments. What started with a potential couch for sale turned into a full-scale operation. She donated her furniture to a mother through a community shelter. And from there, the idea to create a nonprofit took off. Donations rolled in. Demand soared. Denny has a full-time job, but she would spend hours driving and delivering furniture to families on weekends. And for Denny, the mission is personal.
I'm a survivor myself. And I just felt that I needed to do something back, give back to the community. Just from the experiences I went through, had I known that there were so many other resources out there, I probably wouldn't have stayed so long in some of these really horrible relationships.
At a storage unit in Wanakee, Denny is moving furniture and directing volunteers.
Okay, you guys want to grab this dresser?
Okay. I got it.
Careful. Hey, you're going to break that. It's a canvas. Come this way.
Denny says many of the women she works with have gone through hardships. Some are homeless. Others have been raped. And she says when people finally get a job or their own apartment and come back to an empty home, it only makes it that much harder to leave the abusive situation.
That's when you always start questioning, did I make the right decision? Should I go back? Because usually the abusers would keep finances for them, and that's how they trap them.
Denise says that's why helping people during what is sometimes their most vulnerable moment is so important.
So we are that missing aspect to make that home a sanctuary for them. That way they know that they are making the right decisions, they are in the right steps, they are heading the right direction, they can just move forward and become, you know, the beautiful women that they are, that they deserve to be.
You guys might want to go the other way so you can turn it, like come out.
Denny and her team eventually arrive at a Sun Prairie apartment and begin to unload furniture for sisters Jaisha and Jessica Edwards.
All right, it's kind of a tight squeeze.
After their mom died in 2015, the Edwards family bounced around from Chicago to Sun Prairie. Jessica says her family had been on the waiting list for a new apartment for over a year.
Is there so many emotions going on right now inside of me? Like, I don't know whether to cry, smile, you know. I'm just blessed because a few years ago today, I would have never thought we would have been here.
And to top it off, their home comes fully furnished. As she looks to the future, Denny says the bigger the donation closet gets, the more families they can help.
I think when it really hits me is when we're there and then we walk in and we're done with everything and then like their whole house is filled of everything, that the moms get emotional, and that's like usually when it gets me. Because then I'm like, oh my God, don't cry. It's going to be good now.
WPR's Gabby Vinnick brought us that story on Felicia's donation closet in Dane County. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine difficulties in cultivating native wild rice and this years-long effort underway in Oneida County to bring back rice beds on Spur Lake. You can be part of this discussion about wild rice. Call in with a question or a comment at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Carly Lapin is regional ecologist for North Central Wisconsin at the Department of Natural Resources Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation. Carly, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate.
Good morning. And you're joined by Nathan Podney, who is a hydrologist for the Scoggin Chippewa community, Mole Lake Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. Nathan, welcome back.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Nathan, let's start with you. Why is wild rice restoration so important to tribal communities living near Spur Lake?
Yeah, great question. I've worked for the Scoggin Chippewa community for about 8 years now, and their connection to wild rice is tangible. The lake on the reservation, when it's performing, there's a sense of pride and community. And over the years, as we all know, the prevalence of rice across the landscape has decreased. So being able to be a part of this project and opportunity to bring rice back, which was once abundant on Spur Lake, is immeasurable and very important to us in the Scoggin Chippewa community.
Carly, how do you reflect on that cultural significance, that spiritual significance of wild rice for Ojibwe people?
I have really been honored to observe the importance of this resource for the local community. It's been really a great opportunity to be able to partner with Nathan and the Scoggin Chippewa community on this project. I've learned a lot, and the support means a lot to me. And it has been a really great experience.
Well, take us back. In 2019, your working group started the wild rice restoration project. Wild rice plants are starting, apparently, to appear on Spur Lake. Tell us about this timeline. How are you seeking to improve rice growth?
In 2019, the effort began actually as a climate adaptation project. There had been a lot of questions about why rice had been declining on the lake over the years, especially since the late 90s. Spur at one point had been one of the better ricing lakes in the county. And before I undertook a climate adaptation project like that, I wanted to involve local partners because there are a lot of stakeholders who have an interest in this lake and the rice there. And so we formed a Spur Lake working and identified a number of different steps that we could take to better understand the system and what was happening there and potentially see if we couldn't do something to restore the rice.
Walk us through some of those steps. What has that process been like so that you could become closer to the lake and what's happening to these rice beds?
We have been examining the hydraulics of the system, the hydrologic components, and we're able to, with some funding, from donors, hire out a hydrologic study of the whole system and get a better understanding of the history of the site, what sort of changes had occurred on the landscape, different infrastructural changes that potentially have resulted in higher water levels over time. That, along with different climate change impacts, have what we think negatively impacted the rice. So there are a lot of different factors. Hydrology is different in its length throughout the landscape. So it's been kind of like putting together the pieces of a puzzle through time. And then in the last couple of years, we've had lower water levels once again through natural cycles of water on the landscape, and using that as a cue, we decided to do some more manual manipulations on the lake to remove some of the perennial vegetation that's been outcompeting the rice. And we seeded rice in October of last year and are monitoring the results right now. We do have, yeah, some rice that's growing back in some of our plots.
Some rice that's growing back. Is it at a rate that you think is a comeback? Is it sustainable?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. Typically with ricing or restoring rice in projects like these, you would reseed for 3 years in a row.
Okay.
And monitor the results. So,
Nathan, from your hydrology perspective and the working group studying Spur Lake to find out what's driving this decline, what does the research say?
Yeah, well, we know just across the landscape, we've lost about 50% of our wetlands, either in the state, either from drying out or human manipulation. But we've also installed a lot of culverts and severed connectivity. And we've seen this on a lot of lakes where undersized culverts, which cannot convey the normal amount of flow, will lead to ponding in the lakes. And especially in spring, when wild rice is most susceptible to being ripped up or even potentially drowned, the severance of connection and undersized culverts has shown to be really, really negative for a lot of lakes. And we've seen that, but we were wondering what the factors were for Spur Lake. And when we did this hydraulic study and took elevations at the outlet of Spur Lake and down the stream channel, we didn't see as much of a difference as we thought we'd see. There was really no smoking gun. Yes, under large rain events and large events which would cause a lot of water flowing out of Spur Lake, we did see a difference in the upstream. So at Spur Lake, higher water levels prevailed. But not to the extent that we thought that it would completely destroy the rice bed the last 2 decades, as Carly said. Hmm. But there was really no smoking gun as far as the downstream culverts, which would have been great, because then you just, you know, pull them out, do the construction, replace it, and get the water moving out of the system, and rice will ideally come back. But there's a lot of variables at play, and that's why Carly mentioned climate change. And she also mentioned this period of low water that we're trying to take advantage of. So really, we want to recreate the qualities of Spur Lake from 20 years ago. So we do want to still replace those culverts, and we do want to knock back some of this vegetation. But it's hard to really narrow down what is occurring at Spur Lake.
That is hydrologist Nathan Podney for the Scoggin Chippewa community and regional ecologist Carly Lapin at the DNR's Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation. As we discuss wild rice cultivation, be part of the discussion at any point. Call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We check in on wild rice restoration efforts underway at Spur Lake in northern Wisconsin and how to make lakes like this one productive for growing wild rice. It's an integral part of the culture of Indigenous communities. Call in with a question, your thoughts along the way, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Nathan Podney is here, hydrologist for the Sacagan Chippewa community, and Carly Lapin, ecologist with the DNR's Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation, both working on Spur Lake's wild rice cultivation. Carly, how are people's lives in the watershed and how they live around and along Spur Lake? How does that affect the life and the ability to maintain rice beds on Spur Lake?
That's a good question. Spur Lake is actually a pretty intact system in its own. The lake itself doesn't have any development on it and is surrounded by high quality wetland communities and upland communities. There are a few residents in the area who live nearby, and every time we're out there working, the local neighbors almost always stop and want to know what we're doing. And there's always comments on how much rice there used to be, and people are very positive and happy to hear that we are trying to reinvigorate the rice on the lake.
Can you explain how does wild rice growth support the surrounding environment and life on the lake?
Sure. Rice is an important, ecologically, it's an important plant species. Lots of different wildlife use it as food and cover, especially waterfowl, water birds. It's an annual species that reseeds itself in the fall. The rice grains overwinter on the bottom of the lake, typically in silty sediment, and then will re-sprout in the spring. It is an interesting aquatic species in that it has an underwater, a floating leaf, and an emergent form, all of which occur during the course of the growing season. So typically, the rice will start to sprout right as soon as the ice goes off the lake. And then into June, it'll be floating on the surface of the water, and that's when it's really susceptible to wake or large changes in water levels. And then it begins to emerge from the water to stand up in July. It fruits and pollinates throughout the course of July and August, and then the seed begins to form and can be harvested typically in early September.
Can you explain how it's harvested, how it's collected and gets off the stalk?
So there are some regulations about rice harvest in the state. Typically, it's harvested in the cultural traditional way, by knocking it into canoes.
Okay. Nathan, talk about if you could address the waterways. Twin Lakes Creek connects to Spur Lake. The stream joins the Pelican River, which in turn flows to the Wisconsin River. Can you describe the work being done in waterways to improve rice growth?
Yeah, we touched a little bit about looking at culverts and the hydraulic study, and maybe for this conversation, I'd like to concentrate a little bit more on some of the work being done in the lake. Spur Lake is a little different than a traditional rice water. Usually we want to see an inlet and an outlet. That inlet or that water coming into the lake is great for bringing nutrients into a system, and that allows the lake to perform on an annual basis. Now, we do see wild rice waters that can thrive with springs or in lakes with just currents, but a lot of times those lakes will see larger fluctuations 1 year to the next just due to the lack of nutrients. So there's some internal nutrient cycling going on in the lake. And if you have a really good year, you're less likely to have a good year that next year. But if you have a source of water coming in, like a stream, then we'll see those lakes perform a bit better. But in Spur Lake right now, what we're trying to do is remove some of that perennial vegetation that can compete and even outcompete rice. Because at some point, Spur Lake must have reached a tipping point. You know, the lake was covered in rice, and now it's covered in floating leaf and emergent vegetation. And we knew from work on other lakes that if we knock back some of those lilies, some of those floating leaf plants, we could give rice a better chance to succeed through germination, through a submerged and emergent stage and knock back some of that competition. So what we ended up doing is we brought a swamp devil, which is really a large rototiller, mm-hmm. into the lake. And we cut up 1-acre plots in three different study areas. And we really wanted to see how the lake would respond without seeding. Because you can imagine seeding takes a lot of time, money, and effort. You have sure. to be on the lake, buy the rice. You have to make sure that rice doesn't dry out, so store it. And then you have to go out into the lake in canoes because this lake doesn't have a boat landing. Spur Lake doesn't have a boat landing. And we have to actually hand spread it. So in those plots, if the rice came back without seeding, we would know that there's a vigorous and robust seed bank. And we could kind of depend on the lake to take care of itself after we remove the vegetation. However, we also wanted to reseed one of those areas that we removed the vegetation to, just in case that seed bank was, you know, in fact, kind of not there. After 20 years of poor rice production, not replenishing its seed bank, and that kind of seems to be the case. It seems like we're going to have to remove vegetation and reseed it to get a response.
Thank you for, you know, really sharing that living experiment that is underway. And so I think what I'm hearing is invasive aquatic plants could be also stifling the wild rice in trying to grow.
Yeah, in some instances, that's definitely the case. Huh. In other instances, and specific to Spur Lake, it's less so invasives, but other aquatic plants that have taken over. We'll see in a lot of systems with stagnant water levels, and this can be caused by undersized culverts too, where you don't get that large fluctuation, which yes, can be bad for rice, but it also is, it mitigates the amount of perennial vegetation, and rice as an annual can bounce back from that. So on Spur Lake, maybe we're seeing too much of stagnant high water levels that have allowed these perennial plants proliferate.
They need to be flushed out a bit. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, Carly, I just want to give you a final word here. What is needed in future months to really keep the rice plants as healthy as possible and keep this work going?
At this point, I think we're just going to continue monitoring. We do plan to seed more rice again at the end of this growing season and next summer as well. But we're planning to monitor to see what happens. At this point, we'd really like to just see what unfolds at Spur Lake so we can get a better understanding of what's happening there and then decide if we want to expand those efforts either within Spur Lake itself or perhaps on other water bodies where we're seeing similar issues with wild rice.
Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Thank you.
Carly Lapin is North Central Wisconsin Regional Ecologist for the Department of Natural Resources Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation, and Nathan Podney, Hydrologist for the Skagen Chippewa Community Mole Lake Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.